Good evening and welcome to Webinar Wednesday. And we're very happy to have with us this evening Sister Claire Millay, who's going to be speaking to us about Blessed Clelia, and in a sense, blessed is she. She's going to share a little bit about the beatification and some examples of graces and things that have happened to Mother Clelia that will certainly be inspiring for all of us. So I'll ask all of us to silence our microphones. And then if there is a time that's open, Sister Claire will give you a heads up and then you can unmute your microphone. Okay, so thank you for joining us.
Okay. Well, hello everyone. This is my first webinar, so hope everything works and doesn't shut down on us. As Sister Angela said, I went to the beatification of Mother Clelia. Just came home a few days ago. And it was a wonderful, wonderful experience. There were sisters from all over the world and about 3,000 people altogether, maybe a little more, at St. John Lateran in Rome for the ceremony of beatification. And I've been thinking about different aspects of it, and in itself it was just a wonderful, uplifting ceremony. But it's more than a ceremony. It's the end of a long, long journey of verifying her holiness. And the word beatification comes from, the meaning is blessed. And I was just thinking the last couple of days, what does blessed mean? And blessed is a gospel word. Remember, Jesus spoke to the people and he gave them a whole list of reasons why they would be blessed. And so when I read those over, I said, wow, this is really Mother Clelia's life. I don't know, Audrey and Laura, I don't know if you know some of Mother Clelia's life story, but she had so many difficulties in her life. And just reading these, I'll just let me read these in the way they are in Matthew's gospel. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Okay, theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are they who mourn. Blessed are they who hunger and thirst after justice. Blessed are the merciful, the clean of heart, the peacemakers, and those who suffer persecution for justice's sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And Mother Clelia truly lived all of these. She had so many trials during her life that it seemed like a very difficult, painful life. And yet she was blessed. She was favored by God. She was given graces continually throughout her life to bear the sufferings that she went through and to know that it was her way of uniting herself to Jesus who suffered for us. When I was thinking about this word blessed, I sometimes go to a mass in New Britain that is with a Hispanic pastor. And sometimes one mass he does in English and the other one in Spanish, but they're mostly people are Hispanic in them. And he'll start the mass with the sign of the cross. And then he'd say, and how are you feeling today? And the first times I was, oh, wow. Because when they do it in Spanish, they say, so correct me if I'm not saying it right, bendecidos. And then if he's in English, he goes, how are you feeling today? Blessed. And I think that's such a beautiful way to start the mass. And it reminds us we have so many blessings we receive from God. And that's the kind of blessedness that the gospel talks about. And everyone there has their heartaches and their family difficulties and their difficulties at work, etc. But they are blessed by God and they know it. It was a long road for Clelia to get to receive that title of blessed. And I was thinking it's been at least 40 years actively that the cause has been worked on. And even before that, they were gathering information. She had to go through like a trial. They called it a process in the Diocese of Rome, to check all witnesses and to get them to swear under oath what they knew about her and to get all documentation of her family, of herself, where she was, gather all her letters. And it seemed like forever we thought we didn't have enough information that would be able to make a case for her holiness. But it really, at the end, it turned out to be abundant, the amount of information we found out about her. And when that was all verified, and all they did, they didn't judge on her holiness or not in the diocese, but they just said that everything that they had gathered was authentic. Brought it all over, sealed it in big boxes, all these manuscripts, sent it over to the Congregation for the Causes of the Saints. And it took several years there as well. I see Sister Marianne is joining us. Hi, Sister Marianne. Okay. And, so from there, this Positio, this big two-volume, each volume was really thick, several hundred pages of her life, of all the testimonies, the people who bore witness to her, all kinds of documents, a lot of other kind of information. That Positio was written over a period of many years, a lot of research. And the church had to see three different things. Did she live the virtues in a heroic way, which would mean beyond human ability? And when you see, listen to and you hear about some of the sufferings she bore, it's really almost impossible humanly for a person to suffer the slander and the insults and the lies about her and not either react in a violent way, an aggressive way, or fall apart, just break down. And she didn't. She kept all that in. She just forgave from the bottom of her heart and never talked about what people did or said about her. And these were real proofs of her holiness, her heroic virtue. Then the second thing they have to have is a reputation for holiness. Somebody could be really, really holy, but if nobody knows about them and nobody prays to them or thinks about them, what's the purpose of doing a whole trial, a whole process of to see if she could become a saint? And through the years, even from the time she first died, people recognized her holiness and began to pray for inspiration, for graces, and they were able to, they received them from the beginning. Hi, Allison. So we've got groups of lay people throughout the world, wherever our sisters are, that are following her spirituality. Some of you know the GFAS people, the Great Family of the Sacred Heart, and there were hundreds and hundreds of these people at the beatification who meet regularly, reflect on her writings along with sacred scripture, do works of charity, works of service in their parish, but according to what Mother Clelia taught, which is what's in the gospel, but the love of Christ, the compassion of Christ. And I've met lay people who say, well, you know, this was happening in my life, and then I thought, well, this morning Mother Clelia told me this. And this woman who told me that every morning after breakfast would read a thought from Mother Clelia and refer to it during the day. And I thought, wow, that's really a disciple of really of Jesus, but along the way that Mother Clelia taught. And then the third thing that we need the heroic virtue, the reputation for holiness, and a miracle. And miracle was of a doctor in 1951 who was dying of Guillain-Barré syndrome, which paralyzed his whole body. So he couldn't talk, he couldn't swallow. The syndrome starts with the nerves in the lower part of the body and go up. And he was a doctor in the hospital, and his friends, the other doctors, left him that night saying, tomorrow when we come, Pedro is not going to be here. We will have died during the night because he couldn't live. And the sisters with the family started praying to Mother Clelia, and one of them took a thread from a little relic, put it on a spoon with some water, and gave it to him as they were praying, and he was able to swallow it. Then he swallowed some more water, and Sister Elizabeth said that it's some pudding, I think, too. Yeah. I didn't know that detail. And when the doctors, his friends arrived the next morning, they were expecting to see the death notice on the wall. And instead, they didn't see anything that he had done. He went to his room and he was sitting up talking, and he was completely cured of his illness. He has a daughter who is still alive. She's 82 and she's a religious in Brazil, but she didn't feel up to making the trip to the beatification, even though her father's miracle was the one that put it over the top. But her superior came. I sat next to her at the beatification. So anyhow, it was an old miracle, but they had all the documentation that whatever happened could not have happened by natural or scientific reasons or for medicine, which didn't exist at the time. Okay. One of the other highlights I know for our sisters, and if we're able to watch anything on YouTube or on television about the beatification, was seeing her incorrupt body. Now, she died in 1930, so that's, 88 years ago. So that from 1930 to 1945, her body was in a cemetery in Rome, and the American soldiers bombed that cemetery during World War II. So all the graves were upturned and there was muddy water all around, but they found her coffin. And at that time, when they opened it up, her body was totally flexible and she had good color in her cheeks. And, you know, if you touched her skin, it was like a living person after 15 years in the ground and in that muddy water. The last times. And so they washed her body, they put a clean habit on her, and they put her in a tomb in the wall in our General A Chapel. And she was there from 1945 till about 6 months ago. And they took the coffin out with some officials from the Vatican there with them. And they opened up the coffin, and her body had it had hardened. It had turned like mummified, and it was dark, but it was definitely her. The doctors were studying each millimeter of her facial features and looking at the pictures that we have of her, and they said that absolutely is her face. So it's not soft and flexible like it was. And the church says that oftentimes when God wants us to really know this person is a saint, the first time they open it, the body is completely normal, completely flexible. And that's for our benefit, to know that this person really is blessed by God. And then the second time, sometimes they find nothing the second time, but hers was still there. And the forensic doctor who studied her 6 months ago and came back now at the beatification, he said, for 6 months I've tried to understand how her body could still be entire, even though it was hard, like almost like wooden. And he said, there's no scientific explanation why it should be like that. This is an act of God. So at her, and I'm sure you've probably seen at least pictures on the internet of this glass coffin with her body in it. And it was certainly very moving to see when the sisters took back that red cloth that covered the coffin, and we could see her body for the first time. I was curious, as soon as I saw in one hand she had our constitutions, our rule of life, and I said, I want to see what chapters open up to. And so as soon as I could get closer, I saw it says the interior life. And that was very significant, I think, for all of us to know that, you know, what you do and how you serve people is important, how you live in community, but the first thing, the most important thing. It looks like she's really pointing it out, saying, it's your life with Jesus that's the most important, and that's the basis of your whole vocation. Okay. Now, I thought of just adding this little thing here because each of the problems, and then each community and then each sister received a relic of Mother Clelia. And I thought, some people don't know why would you do that? Even the fact of a body that's now in the chapel, you can see her when you go in there. Several years ago, my brother and sister-in-law were over in Rome, and my sister-in-law is a Baptist, and we were going through St. Peter's Basilica, and I was so excited to show them the body of Pope John the 23rd. And there was a couple other saints here and there under different altars. And afterwards she said, why would you want to put a dead body in your church? And I thought, gee, we're really the only ones who do that. But it's it's a sacred relic, you know, and especially if God has given that gift, that they be their body be entire. And in the early church, many Christians, many followers of Jesus were martyred, and they gave their life for Christ. And they were considered sacred as holy people who were brave enough to say, no, I belong to Christ, do what you want with me. And so that the people, the other Christians, would take the body and they would, you know, bury it in a special place where people could reverence the body and say, this is someone who really gave his life or her life, witnessed until death, that they belong to Christ. And as years went on and people would, Christians from other parts of the world would come to pray in Rome, because that's where, you know, Peter was, and that's where, which became the center of our church, they would see these tombs of the martyrs, and they would see these, you know, these marble coffins, and they'd say, oh, you people have them here. And sometimes they would, that's what we have like in the altar of where we celebrate Mass, there's a little space where they put the relics of the saints, and they would often have the tomb of the saint and then celebrate Mass above it. And these people from other parts of the world are saying, you know, it's not fair. You have these bodies of the saints, and they remind you that we have to give our whole life to Jesus. We don't have anything. So that's little by little, this practice of taking a part of the body and putting in a special case came about, so that we have the closeness of the saints, and their body reminds us. To someone who doesn't know, it might sound gruesome, I would think, but it is a very special thing. So I don't know if you got to see, but this is the, this is a relic that my community, St. Maurice in New Britain, received, and it says ASG at the top, and the inner part, like the shape of a heart, and then that little flower is a tiny, tiny cutout, beautiful flower made of some kind of cloth, I guess. And in the middle, in the center of it, is a little piece of tissue from her body. When they opened up the coffin, they took some pieces of her tissue and made these relics, so that, you know, we have this special reminder. We keep ours on we have a little tiny chapel in our community, and we keep the relic right on the side of the altar. I don't think Jesus minds to share the altar with her. And it's just a nice reminder that she is a living person. She's a real presence in our community, and she's our inspiration. She's our mother and our guide. So that's how, why we venerate relics. If at any time anybody wants to ask something, because I'm going to move on to a different topic, if there's anything you want to ask about this, what are you supposed to do? Just turn your mic on. Yeah. Nobody's
on. If you have a question, just unmute.
Okay. Nobody yet. Okay. I could keep going on forever. Okay. I'm sorry. Okay. Now, some of you have read the book that we received a few months ago, Like a Grain of Wheat. You have one in here. It's got the yellow cover. And I noticed that, I know a long time we've always talked about the fact that that gospel image of a grain of wheat that has to fall into the ground and seemingly die, it's buried, it's hidden, nobody pays any attention to it, but unless it dies, it won't bear fruit. From there, that sprout comes out, and then that is what gives us bread. The Eucharistic image as well, but it's the image that's so perfect for Mother Clelia. And so everywhere at the Mother House and in the Basilica, every flower arrangement, a lot of different things they had with sayings of hers had wheat with it. It's become her symbol now. And soon we'll be getting, and I think it's ready, but it must be in shipment somewhere. We're getting another biography of Mother Clelia. The first one we got is pretty heavy, and it's very detailed. I know I devoured it, but not everybody finds that really appealing. But this other one is going to come out. It's called, and I don't know how they translated it, because it says, A Love, Un Amor Sin Cereza. Like, it's a love that doesn't give up or something like that. And it's also got the wheat on it, a little different. But it's a much more easily readable biography. I was reading it in Italian. I am reading it in Italian. And last night I was reading a chapter that just so struck me. Because it's about her time in Via Reggio, where she started our congregation. And you just read these things one after another. And I was thinking of this, and I was thinking the Beatitudes. You know, you're persecuted, you hunger and thirst for but justice isn't given to you. And in this one little chapter, just of a few pages, I said, okay, now this Father Gelmini, who had been her spiritual director when she was up in Como with Anguinella, but she left from there to start her own congregation. But this priest had been her spiritual director there. She somehow meets him in Via Reggio, and my theory on this is because I had read some of the original documents. He had hoped to start this big family of the Sacred Heart, and he would have orphans and old people and like a big thing like Don Guanella did and Cotolengo did and all these people. He was going to do one, and he was going to have sisters to help him, and they would be called the Apostles of the Sacred Heart. Well, he, without telling Mother Clelia, wanted her sisters to just join him and do all that work for him. And apparently they didn't see eye to eye on that. So what did he do? And when she was in Via Reggio, he badmouthed her. And it says here, he who knew her was made up all kinds of lies against her to discredit her because she wouldn't do what he wanted. So the archbishop of this diocese listens to him, never meets Mother Clelia. All the few years she was there, she invited him so many times to come meet the community, see what they were doing. He absolutely refused to see her. There were several sisters, young women who joined them. They had orphans, they had young girls, boarders, they had old women. And they could not have the Blessed Sacrament in their chapel. She asked over and over again. And he said, no. He says, you can't because you're not a fully established congregation. But in the meantime, he refused to even look at their documents to approve them. And he even sent his auxiliary bishop to meet Mother Clelia. He spent time there. He talked to them all. And he said, these sisters are wonderful. They're all about the glory of God and the salvation of souls. That's all they are. But the archbishop wouldn't budge. You know, here we are. Blessed are you. You're persecuted. You're slandered. Blessed are you. And, you know, she had to end up leaving there. And that's when she, you know, moved on and found Bishop Scalabrini. And I was looking at the table of contents of this book, and I said, okay, this chapter is called The Time of Trial. But the chapter before that is a rather ferocious war. There's another one, The Joys and Sorrows of Brazil. This other one, I didn't even get a chance to read these chapters yet. Bishop throws out the founders. That's another bishop. I don't know who that is right now. The Martyrdom of Lies. I resisted for 5 years. Now, that's when she was in isolation in Alessandria. Practically every chapter title is her suffering, you know, and how could you say she's blessed? But she is, because she knew she was uniting her sufferings to those of Jesus, the innocent one who suffered unjustly and who was slandered and who was mistreated and who was misjudged and who died for us. I remember once somebody was, there was a conference about Mother Clelia several years ago at the hospital that Padre Pio founded in Italy, and our sisters work in that hospital. And they had several people, the doctors and different people, on a panel talking about Mother Clelia. And somebody in the audience said, Mother Clelia suffered so much. Where's the joy? And the doctor said, the joy is in her sisters. And that's what happened to that grain of wheat. she suffered all of this so that we could bear fruit. The fruits are in her daughters. And just to be at that ceremony, the joy is so contagious. You know, these thousands of people, and they would all have their orange scarves on. Like, where's that scarf? Asher, did you take it still on the wall? You hid it. She had this thing hanging on the wall. I thought it was a dish rag, but she said that was her, her scarf. I could tease her. Okay, so, and people would just meet these groups of other pilgrims from other clay on the street. Hi! Hugging and kissing, and, you know, and that's the spirit Mother Clay left us. But she paid dearly for that. Okay. And they say, by their fruits you shall know them. Okay. Now, just Mother Clelia, she was not able to do much active service while she was a sister. She had so many things against her. She was kind of isolated for a long time. Even when she left our community, she wasn't well, and she was able like to give piano lessons at sometimes and you know, teach things individually to these young women, but I'm sure her dreams were to be actively involved in the apostolate. But she's making up for it. She really is making up for it now, and she always encouraged her sisters to be of service. And just three things I've heard since the beatification. Actually, 2 days before the beatification, our Mother General, Mother Miriam, said that there was a little girl named Elisa, a student of one of our schools in Brazil. She was 9 years old and was extremely ill. The doctor, she was in a coma. She was intubated. The doctor said, there's no hope. Only a miracle could save her, because medically there's nothing they could do to bring her back. Nobody told us what the cause of the illness was, but that's not the important thing. So our general invited us all to pray for Elisa. And that first evening, we prayed the prayer to Mother Clelia together, and then everybody was on different schedules, but we all continued to pray. Everybody I met that was there on pilgrimage, I would tell them, pray for little Elisa, because she's very ill. Let's see if Mother Clelia can help her. So a couple days after the beatification, I asked somebody, I said, what happened to that little girl? And they said, well, they were in touch with the sisters in that town, and Saturday, the day of the beatification, during the ceremony, at that time, she began to improve. Mm. And they said every day she was getting better and better. So since I came home, I haven't heard any updates, but God willing, she's well now. And another story I think is really something. Our general gave the seminarians at the Roman seminary each a copy of her life. And this one young man was, you know, he read her life, and he said he was in a vocational crisis, and he didn't know what he was supposed to do with his life. And should he remain, is this his path or what? And the night before the beatification, we had this sacred oratory. It was a beautiful thing done by a professional choir and orchestra, and the orchestra leader wrote the whole script, and it was like a dialogue between Mother Clelia and her sisters. Some of it was recited, some was put to music. It was really lovely. And the seminarian was coming home, and because it was in the early evening, he was coming home from his classes at the university, and he was walking in front of the church where it was held, where this oratory was being held. And he saw all the people going into the church. He said, I really want to go there. So it was a couple more blocks to the seminary where he was living. He went home, went to the seminary, changed his clothes, and walked out of the seminary. Didn't even ask permission from the rector, but he said, I got to go there. I got to be with Mother. So he walked in. He sat down at the concert, this oratory. And the first thing he heard was, quoting Mother Clelia, only at the end of your life will you be able to look back and see behind you all the flowers that have bloomed because of your good works. And when he heard those words, he felt such a deep peace overcome him. And the peace wouldn't leave him. He just, that spoke to him. And we didn't know anything about this, but the day after the beatification was Sunday morning, and I saw this young man in the chapel for a long, long time. And for a while, he was up next to her tomb, and then he sat on a bench, but he was just sitting there and looking at her body. And that's when afterwards, somebody asked, who was that young seminarian there? And they told us the story. And he said, and the sister said, Sunday morning, he brought a beautiful bouquet of flowers to put at her tomb. And this deep peace remained with him. He realized that God wants him to continue on his journey to become a priest. And the third one, I just heard tonight, one of the sisters that I live with came home and said, you have to hear this story. Her cousin, who lives in another state, was told about that Mother Clay was going to be beatified, and she got up early in the morning to watch the beatification ceremony. And I step back. A week ago, she went to the doctor, and she was told that her ovarian cancer had returned. And so she had just gotten that news a few days before. She watched the beatification, and all she could say afterwards, I feel such a deep peace. I am at peace. I feel great peace. And she just keeps repeating this. Today she went to the doctor who had told her a week ago about her cancer. He found no cancer in her body. So that's a nice smile. Who's that, Laura?
Yeah, I love miracle stories.
Yeah, me too. So, and she's going to come in April. We're going to have our cathedral in Thanksgiving for Mother Clelia. And so they're coming out from pretty far away. And, you know, I think Mother Clelia is really busy. What she couldn't do while she was on Earth, she's making up for now. And God knows how many other stories. You know, those are just, I'm sure we're going to be hearing lots of them. So what time is it? We have time for a few more. You want to hear some more miracle stories? These didn't happen this week, but okay. When I used to go around to visit all of our communities around the world, and I would tell them a few things about, you know, what point we were in the process of beatification, and I'd tell them a couple little things, and just about every community, they'd say, oh, you know what? This happened to so-and-so. This happened to me, and I would hear these stories of graces. Some were little graces, some were spiritual conversions, some were big things. So I just picked out a few typical ones. I really like this. You know, Italians like to feed people, okay, you know, especially pasta. One of our sisters in Italy was a great cook, and her brother was diagnosed, this was like, I don't know, at least 30 years ago, with pancreatic cancer. And at that time, there really was no hope. And so when he found he had this, he got very depressed, and he had four young daughters. And he said, I'm not going to get to bring them, you know, bring them to the altar when they get married. I'm not going to see my grandchildren. And he was just so down. And he wouldn't eat. He was getting very weak. But the doctors wanted to do surgery and see if they could help him somewhat. You know, they didn't promise him a cure. And so sister went home for the weekend, and she was also a nurse besides a good cook. And she said, listen, Monday they want to do surgery. You've got to eat something. You've got to build up your strength a little bit. Otherwise, it's going to be worse for you when you have surgery. He says, what's the use? And she said, listen, you like my homemade lasagna. I'm going to make you some lasagna, and you're going to eat it, and you're going to like it. So he said, all right, just for you, I'll eat it, but I don't feel eating. So anyhow, she ate the lasagna, and she had a little piece of cloth that was part of Mother Clelia's clothing. I don't know where these sisters got this, but a lot of them had these little relics around. And she opened up the lasagna, and she stuck the cloth inside between the layers. And she brought him the lasagna, and she said, here, eat this. And he ate it. And she didn't say a word to him because he was like, don't even try to pray for me because it's not, nothing's going to happen. So she was praying, but she didn't say anything. And the next day he went to the hospital, and before he went into surgery, they wanted to do another x-ray. There was nothing wrong with his pancreas. He never had the surgery. So he brought all his daughters to their weddings, and he saw all his grandchildren grow up and lived a lot longer, a very healthy. Somebody told me the other day they really like this other story. I mean, everybody has the ones they like, but we have many sisters in Brazil who are in hospitals, and some of them are little hospitals, like in little towns, and this one hospital had just opened up an intensive care unit, but not like what we have here. But there was a little more particular attention for these people. And so this day, they had moved in all the equipment that they had, all the beds, and the room was full with patients. And sister was there all day. And so she went home in the evening to have supper and to rest. And they don't have heat in their buildings in Brazil because the winter is so short that they just cover up a little more. And so during the night, sister woke up and she realized the temperature had dropped. And she said, oh my goodness, there's only one nurse on duty in that whole area. And she doesn't know where I stored the blankets. She said, those poor people, they're already so sick, they're going to really be suffering from the cold. So she got up, got dressed, went over to the hospital. And when she walked into the intensive care ward, she saw all of them sleeping peacefully, and they were all covered with a nice warm blanket. And so she looked around, and there was one woman, one patient who was awake. And she went over and she goes, honey, where did you get the blankets? And she said, oh, a sister came in, and she gave each a nice warm blanket and covered us up, and we feel fine. She said, a sister? She said, yeah, she looked like you, but she was dressed in black, because our sisters wear white in the hospitals. So then she went out, and the woman on duty was out in the hallway, and you had to go past her to get into the room. She said, did somebody go by here, like a sister? Nope. She said, I've been here all night. Nobody came by. So guess who that was? That was Mother Clelia. This one happened a couple years ago, last time I was in Brazil. And there was one of our sisters was doing some spiritual direction with a young woman, and she came one day and she said, oh, please, you have to pray for my sister. She and her husband are expecting their first baby, and they really want this baby. But when she went for an ultrasound, the doctor said he has a terrible heart defect, and he's not going to live. And I think they wanted to abort the baby, but she said, no, I'm going to carry him. But she said, all she does is cry and cry. She wants this little baby so badly. So sister gave her some prayer cards and told her, just keep praying with faith, and trust in Mother Clelia. So the girl brought to her sister the prayer cards. I'm not sure. Yeah, I don't think there's any relic or anything, but she brought her the prayer cards. And she said her sister, all day long, she would say that prayer, and she'd be crying and praying and like holding the card to her own stomach and saying, please, please help my baby. And his name was Gabriel. She had already named him. And so she just kept praying this prayer. And then she went back for her next visit. And when the doctor tried to do the ultrasound, he said, I can't see the heart because the baby's turned in a different way. And so she goes like this. She goes, Gabriel, please turn around and show the doctor how Mother Clelia has cured you. And the baby turned right around in her womb, and the doctor did the ultrasound, and his heart was perfect.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I saw a picture of him when he was about 8 months old. He was a beautiful, healthy baby, and no problem with his heart. So she's working hard. Okay. Are you getting bored? Okay. If you are, sorry, but we had a few more minutes. Oh, wait, that's That clock is ahead anyhow. Okay. Okay. All right. Now, I think this is interesting. Well, they're all interesting to me. We have a family in Brazil that has two daughters who are apostles. And the family lives on a farm, and the parents and their other siblings all have to work on the farm. And the two sisters, one was a missionary in Chile, no, Uruguay, and the other one was a missionary in Chile, okay. And they got the message that their father had had a bad stroke. And so they said, you know, they were keeping in touch with their family. But he seemed to be coming out of the stroke. But the two sisters were, you know, they were in a different country, and they said, you know what, I guess it was a time they really, if they left, there was nobody else that would be able to continue the ministries they were doing. So they said, you know what, to their mother, we're just going to stay here. We'll pray. We'll unite our prayers with you, but we really can't come home right now, which was really hard. And I know if they had said, either one or both of them had said, I need to go home and be with my family, they would have received permission. But they said, no, you're there. We'll pray with you, and we'll offer this as a sacrifice for death. So he eventually came home, and he was slowly getting better. But in the morning, they would leave him. You know, they'd feed him and, you know, get him ready for the morning. And then they would all go out to do their farm chores and come back at noontime. And so little by little, he was getting better. And then when it came time for their summer vacation, one of the sisters told me she went home, and he was still in kind of bedridden, but he was able to talk, and he was, you know, really improving. And she said, you know, that I'm really sorry that I couldn't be here when you were so sick. I prayed for you, but I wanted to be with you and keep you company, but I couldn't. And he said, you don't have to worry. I was never alone. He said, you were. She said, you were. And he said, no. When everybody went out to work, the sister used to come in my room, and she'd put a chair near the foot of my bed, and she would sit there and keep me company. And she really didn't talk, but she was there, so I never felt lonely. And again, they'd say, well, what did she look like? Well, she had this long black habit on, and she was really nice and smiled. So I think that, you know, I just love that, because Mother Claudia took the place of these two sisters who offered that sacrifice of not being with Dad. And she took their place. So she's quite a mother. I thought of just one that I wanted to see if it's not on here. Well, I got a bunch of others. Maybe I'll go back. Oh, she's really a good one for couples who can't have children. You know, they pray to her, and maybe some. We have a lot of little Claylias out there. That seems to be one of her specialties. And I wonder, you know, because her mother had lost two little babies. One was just a few weeks old. One was about a year old before Claylia was born. And I'm sure she heard about that. You know, the suffering of her parents when the little babies died. And so she answers all kinds of prayers, but that's one of her specials. Oh, I know what, this one is related to that. One of our sisters told me that as a young sister, she was working in a hospital in Sao Paulo, Brazil. And one of the young doctors in her department, he and his wife were having their first baby, and they were so excited about this little baby coming. And when the baby was born, the baby was perfect, but the mother went into a coma, and the poor dad was beside himself. And this went on for weeks, and he didn't know what to do, because he said, here I am, it's our first child, she's not getting better, how am I ever going to raise this baby by myself? And she kept saying, don't worry, we're praying to Mother Claudia. She's going to be okay. But week after week, no improvement at all. So one morning, sister came into the department, and she sees the head doctor coming out of that woman's bedroom. And he's like, fire coming out of his ears or whatever. And he said, sister, what did you do to this woman during the night? And she said, I wasn't here. I was back in the convent. And he said, well, what about the night nurse, the sister? What did she do? She said, I don't know. She said, let's look at the chart. And so they looked at the chart. There was nothing unusual. And she was so afraid because she said, maybe the woman died. He's going to blame us that we did something wrong. You know. And so he said, come with me. So he goes into the room. And there's the mom sitting in bed eating breakfast. And so he says, tell sister what happened. And she said, well, last night I was sleeping and a nurse came to my bed. And she said, I'm going to give you an injection. And you're going to take this needle, this injection, and it's going to make you sleep and tomorrow you'll be fine. So she did. And here I am. And so she said, okay, wait a minute. So she went behind the back and she lifted up the pillow. And she pulled out a prayer card with Mother Clady's picture on it that she had left there. And she said, yeah, that's the sister who gave me the injection.
Oh, wow.
So she knows how to be a nurse, too. So anyhow, they're signs of holiness. Not every saint does that. Mm-hmm. It, that they appear to people. And why do some do and some don't? I don't know. But I did read once in a book by... about Padre Pio, who used to do that. He still does. He appears to people sometimes too. And this author, this is his theory, that Jesus was above all the laws of nature. Jesus was also, was man and he was God. And he could come into a room without opening the door. And he could, you know, pass through barriers and because he was God. And that there are some people on earth who are so identified with Jesus and his suffering, and certainly Padre Pio was also, that God grants to them, when necessary, the same ability to go beyond the laws of nature and to be where they are not, you know, where they haven't been. And he named some of the people, and I say, Mother Clady, when I was reading this book, add Mother Clady to that list, because she's obviously one who does comfort people and give them the graces they have. So, anyhow, that's who she is, and as soon as we get this book, we'll make sure you get a copy. It's got the same ideas, but it's a little... Okay. Are you asking me? Or?
Uh-huh.
Well, Sister Angela's provoking me. Maybe I spoke to them.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so she wrote me, Sister Angela's sitting here, and she wrote me, what do you think her message is for us? And I said, am I supposed to answer that, or are you supposed to answer that? Anybody want to take a stab at it? All these shy people.
If we trust in God, miracles can happen. We just have to keep trusting and keep praying.
That's right. That's, yeah. And sometimes it's really the very simple people who have the real pure faith that receive their graces. You know, and I confess I do it sometimes. You know, I pray and I say, well, this person's probably going to die anyhow or whatever, but, you know, help them if you think that's appropriate, but. You know, those who can just trust fully do receive graces. Whitney, you raise your hand? Okay. Well, I think, you know, what's her message for us? She has so many messages that I wouldn't know what to pick. But I think what impressed me is, you know, her ability. This time, her humility and just that ability not to take revenge or not to hold grudges. You know, somebody, you know, throws us under the bus, as we would say today. You know, that hurts. And sometimes it's just a little thing, but, you know, that ability to say, Jesus, I unite this with you, whatever it is, whether it's something like that or something that doesn't go our way or we don't understand why, just to see it as coming from the hand of God and be able to live with it in peace. You know, another book we'll be getting soon in the near future is her own diary. And, you know, I've seen part of that. And, you know, like she's that whole ability not to share her hurts just for the, you know, like just to get off my chest and tell her, you know what she did, you know what he said. She never did that. And sometimes I would wonder, maybe she didn't realize. But in her diary, I remember reading, who could I, you know, they offend me, they lie about me, they do all these things to hurt me. But who could I tell except you, Jesus? Oh, if that's not heroic, you know, and I don't think I'll ever get to that state of totally depending just on Jesus and sharing it only with him, but that ability to truly forgive from her heart is just amazing. You know, and I think we all carry some grudges against somebody here and there. And it takes time, it takes God's grace. So, you know, she was docile and she let him, let his grace work in her for whatever he needed. So there's trust in her. And whether you're already on your vocation path or whether you're thinking or whether you're just interested in hearing about somebody who's holy, you know. I met so many young women that, several young women at the beatification who had started on their journey, whether it's aspirants or postulants or whoever, and they were just so happy to be there because they knew, you know, Mother Clelia hasn't dropped me. I'm still her daughter. Yeah. You know, they still look to her and they still ask her and they still converse with her. So there was one of our sisters who was a nurse and there was a problem in the hospital and she wasn't responsible. A baby had died. A young woman was, but as the head nurse, she was going to lose her license and it was a terrible situation. She wasn't allowed to even set foot in the hospital. And she was so desperate that one night she couldn't sleep and she just went into the chapel of the convent. She said, Mother Clelia, am I your daughter or am I not your daughter? If you don't help me to get out of this, how can I stay here as an apostle? I can't do anything to serve if I lose all my certification. And she said the next morning an attorney called her and said, I've been following your case and I can help you. And he resolved it so that she was exonerated. And as she was telling me the story, she sobbed because she said, I realized I never called on Mother Clelia until that night. I was so worried about myself. And that's what a mother does. A mother doesn't say, where have you been up till now? And Mother Clelia is like that too. So, you know, she's a true mother in all senses. So I pray that she'll help each of you on your own journey through life. And she got a lot to think about. So we've got a good guide in her. And I say, she blessed you with 100 hearts is what she liked to say. So I'm sure she's blessing each of you for your attention and your interest in her. Okay? Did we do it okay?
Yeah. A special thank you, Sister Claire.
Okay.
For sharing your love of Mother Clelia and the stories with us. And we'll continue to pray for you. And we'll continue to pray for one another.
Okay. It's a deal. Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Thanks for your attention.
Okay. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Good night.
Bye, everyone.